Thanks, William, and it's good to be here, and let me add my own welcome to Williams.
Just before I start to speak on that question, can Jesus make me happy, I'd like for us to listen to a reading from one of the first century accounts of Jesus' life, so that what I say I can base a little bit on the first century evidence about the person of Jesus. So can you please pick up from your tables one of these Mark's Gospels? And this is yours to take away at the end of this evening if you'd like to. And please turn in it to page 14, where it says, Jesus heals a woman and Jairus' daughter. And I'm going to ask Thea to come and read that, and then I'll be back on my feet just afterwards.
So it's Mark chapter 5 on page 14 of your Gospels. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, and came up behind him in the crowd, and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And the disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked round to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making such a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat.
Thanks, Thea, for that. Now, our question this evening is, can Jesus make me happy? And I want to start by a famous quote by the American writer O. Henry. He famously said, "Life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating." I don't know where you are as you come to this talk, whether you're someone who is life is full of smiles at the moment, and you're not especially looking for Jesus to change anything because life is good as it is. You have a good job, you have a good marriage, you have a nice house, you have good friends, you enjoy hobbies at weekends, and as far as you're concerned, you're sorted. And in fact, you've only come this evening to humour the Christian friend who was really desperate that you'd come. There might be other people here for whom sobs have been the pattern of the last few weeks. Maybe you've been bereaved this year. Maybe you've been one of the casualties of the credit crunch. Maybe you've experienced the pain of a broken relationship or a lost job. But I guess for most of us, as O. Henry said, sniffles predominate. It's not that things are particularly terribly bad or particularly wonderfully happy, but somewhere in between, and all of us just want to get through life the best that we can. Just as happy as we can, as the best that we can make of the cards that life deals us. And so you're probably here this evening because you've humoured your Christian friend and maybe you wonder just a little bit whether Jesus might help with that. Will Jesus help to make me happy? Because after all, that's what most of us want. Now, of course, the media has mocked Christians in their attempts to be happy. I remember when I was doing my PhD, the professor who was head of the department asked me at the Christmas party, "Andrew, I know you're a Christian. Are you one of those happy clappy Christians?" Didn't quite know what to say. I replied, "Well, I am happy. I don't clap all that much." Or maybe you've seen that agonising Catherine Tate episode with Lauren and the schoolteacher when she discovers that the schoolteacher's a Christian, wearing these terrible fashion death clothes. And she goes on, "Does Jesus have you for a sunbeam, miss?" Does she? And it's kind of really embarrassing. Everyone likes to mock Christians for being eternally smiling and naive. And certainly Christians don't have the last word on being happy. There's lots of different things that can make you happy. LSD can make you happy, I'm told. And sex can make you happy. I guess prostitutes make people happy. That's why they earn a living. And gambling can make you happy. And a promotion can make you happy. And a deal that comes through can make you happy. And when she says yes, or he proposes on one knee, that can make you happy. And when you retire, that can make you happy. And no one is saying that Christians have a moratorium on happiness. The question is, does Jesus have something to offer that is more than the other things? Or a happiness that's more secure, maybe, or more definite, or worth putting your trust in? The thing is that most of us, I guess, suspect not. And that's why we have that subtitle for this evening. Can Jesus make me happy? Or, as we more suspect, will he just burden me with guilt and rules? I have to say, this is something of an autobiographical question for me, because when I was at university, I wasn't a Christian. I was, an agnostic or an atheist as a science student, and I was looking into stuff, and I had various questions as I asked my Christian friends from the Christian Union. I wanted to know if Christianity was true. I was interested in evidence and facts and history. I wasn't about to believe something just because a friend told me so with a smile. I looked into it, and I have to say, I found the evidence pretty convincing. But my question then wasn't so much, is this true? It was, will this be good for my life? I'm not so much interested in the philosophy of the religion, but I'm interested in what it means for my future, my relationships, my career, and my happiness. And I have to say, the impression that I'd received growing up in a church, I guess, in the village, and sometimes we went there for special occasions, was that religious people were grumpy and hypocritical, and that religion wasn't going to change my life for the better at all. I want to read you a poem by a bloke called Steve Turner, which I think describes very well what sometimes the institutional church has done with Jesus. It's called How to Hide Jesus, and it goes like this. There are people after Jesus. They've seen the signs. Quick, let's hide him. Let's think. Carpenter, fisherman's friend, disturber of religious comfort. Let's award him a degree in theology, a purple cassock, and a position of respect. They'll never think of licking there. Let's think. His dialect may betray him. His tongue is of the masses. Let's teach him Latin and 17th century English. They'll never think of listening in. Let's think humble, man of sorrows, nowhere to lay his head. We'll build a house for him somewhere away from the poor.
We'll fill it with brass and silence. It's sure to throw them off.
There are people after Jesus. Quick, let's hide him. I like that poem because I think it's pretty fair, isn't it, for what sometimes the institutional church, what songs of praise, what the Vicar of Dibley, what the Archbishop of Canterbury, what all of those things that you had to do in RE at school, what they've done to us in Jesus. We've just got an impression of him which is thoroughly unattractive, of a distant, detached, irrelevant, boring preacher who only wants to burden people, is there to snuff out fun as soon as it arises, and wants you to join him in an interminable sermon that lasts the rest of your life. That was my impression. And the reason I chose this passage from Mark's Gospel to be read tonight is I wanted to choose something that would show you that your impressions, those impressions of Jesus, are entirely wrong. That Jesus is much more than a long sermon or a purple cassock or a cathedral. That the real Jesus is amazing, that he changes people's lives, and that he offers the kind of happiness that you won't find in the LSD, or the relationship, or the promotion, or the retirement. Jesus offers a happiness which is lasting and permanent. I think that's the difference, isn't it? Because it's easy to get happy quickly. It's easy to find the thrill. But actually, that's part of the way that depression works, isn't it? As the psychologists will tell us. You get the thrill, but then the afterwards feels so flat. That's why the depression statistics are on the up, I guess. We're a country, we're a civilization of people who know how to be happy briefly. You can be happy by going shopping. I've done that myself. You buy the new whatever it is, and your life's changed, and then a couple of days later it's looking a little bit old, and you realise how much it costs you when the credit card bill comes through, and you're feeling flat. The new relationship starts brilliantly, it's fantastic, and then it's tough a little bit later, and it ends in tears. The question is Jesus' happiness any different? Well, you might think it was a strange story to read. It's not a story about people who are happy to start with. It's a story about people whose lives are beset by tragedy. And isn't that just the problem with happiness in this world? Whatever kind of happiness you have, it's got to be able to face up to things like sickness, the diagnosis from the doctor that you don't want to hear. It's got to face up to things like death one day. If it's the relationship that makes you happy, it's the relationship that makes you secure. What happens on the day of the funeral when sobs take over? How can I have a happiness that will last in the face of those things in the world that are wrong? And that's the kind of happiness that Jesus offers. And that's why it's permanent. Well, I think this is an amazing story. It's an eyewitness story, and that's partly why I chose it. If you're, like me, sceptical about whether this really happened, then please take away this book and read for yourself what some of the eyewitnesses said about Jesus. The thing that convinces me is just some of the details of the narrative. This will be published just about 30 years or so after Jesus performed the things that happened here. And it was published publicly. It was a very popular book. The church was spreading, the message of Jesus was spreading. And it contains all kinds of details that the first century readers could have checked. So it tells you about something that happened in a synagogue. It tells you where the synagogue was. It tells you that the ruler of the synagogue was a guy called Jairus. And it concerned his daughter, who was 12 years old. See, those are the kind of specifics that you don't put in a make-believe, long, long ago, far, far away story. Because people can check. It was 30 years ago, and it was here. And the guy's name's Jairus, and it was his 12-year-old daughter. Go to the town, ask anyone in her school class. Ask anyone who knows him, did this happen? It's checkable history. So let's look at these two encounters about with Jesus and people in great need that we read about. The first one is a man, Jairus by name, synagogue ruler, who has a daughter at death's door. Look at verse 23, look at number 23, a couple of sentences down.
He came to Jesus and he implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. Jesus has earned something of reputation as a healer. He's in great demand, and he really is the last resort for this man. He comes to him, he pleads with Jesus, "Please come and help my daughter." And so they go on the way. And then agonizingly, as they're on the way for Jesus to try and do something for this sick girl, there's a delay. It's like the equivalent of a traffic jam. And everyone has to wait those agonizing extra minutes as the daughter is lying there. The delay is caused by this woman who'd had a discharge of blood for 12 years, who'd suffered much under many physicians and spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Another terrible situation. Here's a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. And she's tried the medical professionals of the day, and they've taken her cash, and they've administered their quack remedies, and as a result, her health is worse. It's deteriorating. And again, she's desperate. She has only one hope. She comes to Jesus, this healer who she's heard about. "Maybe he can help me," she says. "Even if I even touch his garments, I'll be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body she was healed of her disease. Jesus, perceiving himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "He touched my garments." His disciples said to her, "You see the crowd pressing around you, you say, 'He touched me?'" He looked round to see who'd done it. The woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." I love that story because of what it tells me about the character of Jesus. Here's Jesus, he's busy, he's on a mission to see someone very important, a synagogue ruler's daughter. And he's stopped by nobody in the way, and he stops to encounter her. Here's a woman whose life is desperate. Here's a woman whose life is changed. And then look at how Jesus addresses her at the end. "Daughter, time to start going to church, saying your prayers, changing your ways. Time to start becoming religious, become a nun. Time to stop cutting out the fun, the games. Time to become a Christian." It's not what he says, is it? That's not the kind of change that Jesus makes in this woman's life. "Go in peace, daughter. Your faith in God has healed you. Be healed of your disease." Transformed by a Jesus who reverses the worst conditions of this world. Next encounter, he finally gets to the ruler of the synagogue's house. And some people said to him, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Don't fear, only believe." Well, I like that line because it seems to me slightly reminiscent of what some pop songs have told us about how to be happy, the secret of being happy. So Bobby McFerrin, his famous song, "Don't worry, be happy." Seems like that's what Jesus is saying. You know, "Your daughter's dead, don't worry, just smile." Exactly what we expected, isn't it, from religion. Just put a big smile on, play the guitar, get a rainbow strap, put on your sandals, and just pretend everything's good. Or the Monty Python equivalent. Just look on the bright side of life, and you expect them to go whistling away into the sunset. But of course, happiness isn't as easy as that, is it, when you've just lost a daughter? And so Jesus goes into the house and then says something even more distasteful. He says to them, "The child is not dead, but asleep." Let me tell you, if you're some kind of religious pretender and you fancy yourself as a conjurer or a magician, don't try it at the family home just after the death of a 12-year-old. They laugh, but it's not funny. They laugh in ridicule and scorn. It's a cruel thing to say to a grieving parent. But Jesus put them all outside, took the child's father and mother, those who were with him, went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumai," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking. She was 12 years old. And they were overcome with amazement. Jesus didn't come just to give us kicks. There's other ways of getting kicks. You can get better kicks probably from LSD or from a prostitute or from promotion or a deal or a retirement plan. But Jesus' message was more profound than that. He didn't just want to turn sniffles into smiles by making you laugh or helping you sing along. He wanted to deal with what was wrong with the world. The things that will always stand in the way of true happiness. Those things about the world that tell us that the world isn't the way that its creator wanted it to be. Sickness and sadness, death and disease. Look more widely in the Bible, we find Jesus' diagnosis of the problem is actually to do with our rebellion against God. That's the true problem. Jesus says earlier in Mark's Gospel that he's come as a doctor for the sick, and then he explains, "I've come to call sinners." Our rebellion against God is the reason that this beautiful world isn't always a happy world. Our rebellion against God is the reason that we're selfish. It's the reason that we lie. It's the reason that we betray people. It's the reason that we say harsh things. It's the reason we're impatient. It's often the reason that we make other people cry. It's often the reason that we're not happy. And more profoundly, the effects of that broken relationship with God are felt in the fact that we get ill, and in the fact that we die. And Jesus doesn't just come along and say, "Cheer up." He doesn't just come along and say, "Put a smile on your face and pretend that everything's okay. Don't worry, be happy. Always look on the bright side of life." He comes with power to deal with the problem. To take the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, touch her, and she's healed of her disease. And say to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." To go to the family home of the dead girl and say, "Don't worry, she's just trust me. She's only asleep." And to take her by the hand and raise her up in full view of the whole family, who are amazed. I just want, as we close, to contrast two reactions. Two stories, but two reactions. Two stories, two fears. Jairus, the synagogue ruler's is afraid of his daughter's death. And Jesus says to him, "Don't fear, but trust me." He's saying, if you trust me, you don't need to be afraid of the things that can spoil your joy. You don't even need to be afraid of death. Because I have the power of death. I have the power to raise the dead. Don't be afraid of whatever the world can throw at you. But then notice the contrast with the woman. I think this is very striking. She's also afraid. But she's not afraid of her disease, because her fear comes after she's been healed of the disease. No, she is afraid of Jesus. She comes to him, verse 33, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. I think this is a very striking reaction, isn't it? It's not the fear of someone who you think might wreck your life, because he's just transformed her life. It's not the fear of someone that you fear is going to burden you with guilt, because Jesus said nothing about her past or her guilt. It's the fear of someone who realizes that she has come face to face with her creator, and that he's good, and that he's transformed everything. And he comes to him in fear and trembling
wondering, how will he receive me? That's something that I did some years ago as a first-year student in Cambridge. Having realised that not only was Christianity true, the eyewitness testimony stood up to close scrutiny, but also that the Jesus described by the eyewitnesses wasn't there to spoil my fun, wasn't there to burden me, but could solve the problems that most spoilt this world. He had the answer to sickness, to tears, to death. But as I discovered that, I began to be a little bit afraid of him. Because rather than just a kind of lifestyle option, like LSD, or a prostitute, or a promotion, or retirement, this was my creator that I was staring in the face. And I came to him thinking, what will he make of me? So it might be that you're here just to investigate kind of hedonism options. And I have to say to you, Jesus isn't the only way to be happy, but he's the only way to be happy forever. He's the only one who can solve the things that one day will put an end to the party and will cause the tears to flow. And he is someone to be feared, to be come before and knelt before, because he is none other than our Creator. Thank you for listening, and I expect there'll be things I said that you will disagree with or want to know more about, and so please use those question slips, and I'll be trying to answer those a little bit later on.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. We're going to have dessert now. I hope you've given your orders, or you'll be about to give them anyway. And then in about half an hour's time, we'll stand up and I'll put your questions to Andrew here. What would be a help is if you were to sort out questions earlier, then somebody would be coming around gathering together, and I'll have a chance to group them together so that I can put them to Andrew. So we'll get back to food now and resume again with questions in about half an hour's time. Well, I'm sorry to interrupt yet again. I've just been handed three questions, which we may try and come back to later. Just to say, we've got a large number of questions. What I've tried to do is to group them together, and we'll work through them. We're going to take about 20 minutes, so we won't go over that. And I want to draw your attention to this little sheet on your table. You'll find that in front of you there, entitled Christianity Explored. It's a little, it runs for 3 or 4 weeks, for one evening a week or a Sunday morning. And you'll see it's advertised, and on the inside there are the dates. There's one starting on the 12th of November. That must be just in about 10 days' time. And there's one starting on the 8th. That's this coming Sunday, for 3 sessions on a Sunday morning. And those are opportunities to go back into Mark's Gospel, to read it for yourself in a guided way, and to have all your questions, to ask any question you like in a little small group in an informal way. So just an opportunity to do that if you're interested. I'll come back and mention that again. Now, Andrew, here he is. We got him in front of us. Religions. Why is Christianity the... Incidentally, thanks for the talk, Andrew. So it was just before we head down this path.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much for it. Why is Christianity the right answer? 500 million Buddhists wouldn't agree with you, nor would the Jews or Muslims. And can other gods make us happy? If God is everything and everyone, and people accept God in different forms, can this constitute happiness? What does Jesus have that other religions don't?
Thank you very much. I think the first thing I'd say is that different religions in the world aren't actually saying the same thing as each other, contrary to what I was taught in RE at school. Religions are all different ways of saying the same thing, said our RE teacher, because that was the kind of government line at the time. I think that's quite patronising. It's obviously not true. So, for example, Christianity thinks there's one God in three persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Islam thinks there's one God, but thinks the idea of a father and a son is blasphemy. Hinduism thinks there's hundreds of gods. Buddhism thinks there's no God. Christianity says that Jesus died on the cross to save us from our sins. Islam says that Jesus didn't die. They're not saying the same thing. They cannot both be true. Jesus cannot have died and have not died. And so I think that's more to do with the kind of slightly patronizing but well-intentioned attempt to make sure we don't fight. You know, if we can pretend that we all think the same, then we're not going to have wars. We're all scared of wars in the name of religion. I think a much better way is to say, look, we don't agree, and let's talk about it, but let's not kill each other. Yeah, so to have a discussion without a war.
Andrew, why is it that Jesus is right then?
Yeah. I think you could start in any order, I think. If you're going to be a responsible investigator of religion, you could start with Islam and read the Quran and check it out. Or you could start with Christianity and check it out. I started here, you could start somewhere else. But if Jesus convinces you that he is true, that automatically excludes the other options. Because Jesus said, for example, I'm the way, the truth and the life. No one can come to God the Father except through me. Jesus' early followers said that they found salvation in no one else. There's no other name under heaven by which men must be saved. So if that's right, then your search is over, because Jesus himself said he was the only one. If that's wrong, then you've got to go looking elsewhere for the answers. I think Jesus is true, and I think his miracles attest that and prove that. Even more than that, I think that Jesus' death and resurrection is unique. Obviously, it's unique in the sense of no one saying that Muhammad died and rose again. But I don't mean just that. I mean it's unique in what it achieves. So Jesus said that his death was a death for the forgiveness of sins. As he died, he paid for all the wrongs that we had done before God. And his resurrection was a victory over death. That having paid the penalty for what we'd done wrong, he was able to win us eternal life. I don't know anywhere else in another religion that tells me that God has done something to make forgiveness possible when I fail. And I know of no other religion that can prove to me that it has an answer to death. And so I think Jesus' death and resurrection tell me he's the only one. But you'd want to check that out, and you should.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thanks for that. We'll move on to quite a stack of questions on evidence. What other evidence is there to show that it was eyewitness accounts, aside from the Bible itself? Furthermore, surely there are several detailed narratives which are fictional. The Bible's been attacked for being inconsistent, out of date. Is there any other evidence you have for Jesus, God, that is completely believable? Everything you say about Jesus' happiness, what happens when faith and belief goes? So evidence and faith.
Yeah, thank you. So the question is there any other evidence apart from what's in the Bible? I want to just say that's a slightly unfair way of wording the question. I'll explain why. The Bible wasn't just one religious book that was in churches originally. I mean, it's actually a collection of lots of different documents that were collected together for ease of use so that you carry them all around with you. But for example, the Bible contains four different biographies of Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This is Mark. It contains letters by some of Jesus' eyewitness followers to early Christians, helping them to understand what Jesus said. It contains a history of the first Christians and what they got up to over the first decades of the Christian church. And all of those, for ease of use, were bound together in one volume. So to say, is there any other evidence apart from what's in the Bible, is a bit like saying, is there anything apart from all the things that they gathered together in one place precisely because they were the evidence? That makes sense. It's in the Bible because somebody bound it all in one book, all of the different bits of evidence. So this isn't just one bit of evidence. This is Mark's contribution. In the Bible, you also find Matthew's contribution, Luke's evidence, John's eyewitness evidence. You'll find letters of the Apostle Paul. You'll find Peter's letters. He was one of the eyewitnesses. John's letters. He's one of the eyewitnesses. And I would say, start with some of those things before you look for other evidence. The whole point is in the Bible. It's just that for your ease, someone's put it all in the same place. But there's lots of different documents that you should be looking at, all of them in the Bible. And start with this one. I just read to you half of one of the pages of quite a short book about Jesus. And don't stop there. You know, if you've never thought about Jesus before, don't come one evening, hear a paragraph and say, I've heard enough. If you want evidence, at least read this, very short, and get one person's take on the evidence. And if you want more, then look at Luke's. If you want more, look at someone else's. There is some stuff that's not in the Bible. Some Roman records mention Jesus. Some of the archaeology ties in with the Bible. Some Jewish history ties in with the Bible. But most of the important stuff is here. And I wouldn't dismiss this until you've mined this and then say, is there any other, if this hasn't satisfied you?
And, I mean, just to push you a little bit, are there other areas of life and aspects that make you say, actually, yes, what I'm reading here, that really does line up? So just to push you on the external thing.
Yeah. I'll say two different things. Firstly, let me just say about evidence for other things that you believe. So I used to give Christians quite a hard time because I always wanted to find objections for believing in Jesus because I thought he wouldn't make me happy. So I was expert in bringing up problems. But what I never did was examine my own beliefs with the same kind of scrutiny. So if you're sitting there thinking, I want an infinite amount of evidence before I believe something, I want to ask you, how much evidence do you have for your current view of the world? So my view of the world used to be that I came about entirely by chance, and there's a big bang which happened by accident, and that DNA just happened to get lucky, and then I just happened to be here. And if you ask me, what evidence did I have for that? The answer was none. Except that it was what a couple of atheist books I'd read had said, and it got me off having to be a Christian. So I would say to you, examine your own view of the world with the same scrutiny that you bring to Christianity and be fair-minded. I hadn't done that. But in terms of the Bible, why trust it? Why trust these documents, the eyewitness documents? As I said, the message about Jesus, if you were making something up, I think you'd say, long, long ago, far, far away. Because that protects you from scrutiny. You know, you'd say, we were off on a holiday with Jesus in Egypt, and we were in the desert and in a cave, and there's only the three of us there, but you won't believe what he did, and no one can check, because you're the only people that were there. What I wouldn't say is, tell you the place it happened, tell you the name of the guy whose daughter it was, and tell people that well within the lifetimes of these guys still being around, because then it can be checked. I also wouldn't tell you that, and keep telling you that, when I myself was persecuted for following this new cult that the Roman Empire persecuted and that the Jewish faith persecuted. And I'd stop saying that after I'd been flogged and thrown in prison and will never say it again. I think, what's in it for me? This isn't a make up a religion and get rich. This is a persist in saying stuff that you saw because you saw it happen. And those kinds of things convince me. As I say, I got convinced it was true long before I got convinced that it would make my life better. And so I was in this weird situation where I thought, it's true, but I don't want it to be true. But the evidence it's true is good and strong, I'd say.
Thank you. Just stand forward a bit, Andrew, because I think otherwise people will see me instead, which is a pity. I think you've answered this, really. Anything you want to say on, you know, there are these couple of questions. What made you believe in religion more than science? What exactly led you to decide that religion was the answer? Actual faith or the need for an emotional strut? Sorry that that's... what evidence turned you as a scientist to Jesus? Just a couple of sentences.
Yeah. I would reject the science or religion categories. I know that's the categories that Richard Dawkins has tried to use. There are many leading scientists today who are Christians. I think it's a kind of category mistake. Science is a set of tools of investigation for understanding the world, and atheism is a faith. And some scientists who are atheists want to pretend that atheism is what science says. Actually, it's just what their atheism says. So I'd say, as a scientist, it means you're interested in evidence and believing things on the basis of facts. And what I'm inviting people to do today is to look at evidence and make a decision based on it, so which is it's a kind of scientifically responsible thing to do. So I don't think it was less scientific of me to embrace Jesus. It was just me having courage to trust what I actually thought was quite persuasive, but I was scared of.
Thank you. I think it's worth saying, on the table as you go out on the right, there are lots of resources. Is Saatchi's talk on science and Christianity there on that table, Elspeth? Find out and give me a wave in a minute and let me know. Just shout yes. If not, you can get it on the website. It's very easy, and somebody who brought you this evening will tell you how to get hold of it. What's the talk called?
I know one place it's definitely on the web. It's on the website of the Fleet Street Talks. If you Google Fleet Street Talks, and then on the homepage there's a talk saying, "Does Science Disprove God?" and you can MP3 it.
There you go. Now, look, I think you've partly answered this already, so very quick answers, please. How can we trust that the story about the woman bleeding and Jairus' daughter raising from the dead is true? Anyone can put details in a story. And I don't understand, are the stories being metaphors about what really happened? If so, what are they metaphors for? If not, and they're literal, how did he do it?
Good question. They're not metaphors. Jesus does tell stories in the gospel. So he tells parables, which are little stories or little metaphors for things. But Mark distinguishes very carefully between when he's using narrative, describing stuff that happens, and when he's telling an illustrative story. And that, all I can say is read it yourself, but you'll see that it's very easy to tell when he's using a metaphor and when he's telling you about something that happened. The other thing I'd say is that the genre of kind of realistic fiction. Now, we read stories about people who lived in certain places and did normal things, had certain families and stuff. That genre of literature doesn't exist in first century Palestine. This is one of the points that C.S. Lewis makes. You know, he's the guy who wrote the Narnia stories. He was also a professor of literature in both Oxford and Cambridge. He knew a lot about literature. And he said the thing that struck him as a literature professor, atheist, reading the Gospels, was that here was a genre of writing that just had not existed before. You have Greek myths, you know, where, and you know about the Greek myths, and they're kind of fanciful stories. You don't have, anyone has ever written before, this happened in this place with these people as a kind of story. It just doesn't exist as a genre in the kind of modern novel. So there's no question that Mark intends us to read this as narrative history.
Thank you very much. That's extremely helpful. Jesus' identity, a couple of questions here. How is Jesus the creator? Isn't that God? If Jesus has the status of God, equal the Father of the Old Testament, how can he have not known who had touched him? So can we just, the identity of Jesus, and then that little point about how did he know whether he was being touched?
Yeah. I'll start with that. I don't think it's obvious from the text that he didn't know. It may have been that he asked a question to give the woman an opportunity to come forward. You know, who was it who touched me? And she comes in fear and trembling. And one of the other gospel accounts suggests that he does know because he looks right at her as he heals her. So I'm not sure that's certain from the text that he doesn't know. Is he God? Well, yes, that would be the early Christian claim, precisely because they witnessed him do things that God alone could do. They saw him with the authority to forgive sins. They saw him with the Creator's control. Just before this in Mark's Gospel, they're on a boat trip on the sea and there's a terrible storm. And they're all worried they're going to die. All the sailors think they're going to die. And Jesus just addresses the waves and says, "Quiet." And the storm is flattened and it's completely still. And these fishermen are absolutely terrified at this. Because Jesus demonstrates the kind of control over the world that only the God who made the world would have. And so they do arrive at the conclusion, the end of John's eyewitness account. He records how one of the apostles, doubting Thomas, when he saw Jesus raised from the dead, he bowed before him and said, "My Lord and my God," which for a Jew would be blasphemy to call a man God. And he was a Jew, but he'd become convinced that Jesus could be none other than the creator of the world in human form.
Andrew, thank you very much. If Jesus has come and is that great, why is sickness still present? Why does death take those we love away? And why then isn't everyone Christian? If Jesus had these wonderful powers, why doesn't he help more people, particularly children? Can Jesus make me happy if he doesn't bring my child back to life or heal my physical sickness?
Thank you very much. I'm really grateful for those questions because I think it was something I wasn't very clear about in the talk. And so thank you for the opportunity of that clarification. I'm certainly not saying that if you become a Christian, you will get better from whatever the doctor told you that you had and that your family will all live forever immediately starting now. I mean, obviously that's not true. And the question is, you know, if Jesus does have the power over death and the power over sickness, Why are there still sick people and why are people still dying? It's an excellent question. And I think the answer to that is that Jesus' coming, the coming of Jesus predicted in the Old Testament, comes in two stages. So in the Old Testament, the Jews were looking forward to a Messiah who would bring the world to a final judgment. There'd be a judgment day, and God would destroy evil and bring about a perfect kingdom. And so the Jews were expecting their Messiah to come as a judge and to drive out the Romans and to destroy evil and to bring about a paradise, a utopia. And when Jesus came, even though in various ways he did amazing things and convinced many Jews that he was the Messiah, he didn't do all the Messiah expected things. In particular, he didn't bring an end to all evil and he didn't sit in judgment on the world. Now, Jesus explains that the reason for that is that he's coming twice. He came once to announce his kingdom, to prove his kingdom, to give a little glimpse of his kingdom, almost like a movie trailer, to go around the villages of northern Israel in particular, healing people, doing miracles. People could watch and see, yes, this really must be the Messiah who one day is going to restore everything. He gave like a little a preview in real history of what he's going to do. But he didn't do the whole thing. And the reason for that is the only way that God can finally remove all the evil and suffering from the world is if he removes all the evil from the world. You can't have a perfect world if people are still going to be selfish because they're going to spoil the perfect world. And you can't have the perfect world if people are still going to lie and break relationships and sleep around because that will destroy the perfect world. People will start crying again as soon as you've made it perfect. The only way that God can have a perfect world is by destroying evil. But when God destroys evil, it's judgment day. And that means the destruction of everyone who has opposed God and hasn't put their trust in Jesus. And so Jesus explains he's coming twice. Once to announce his rescue, to prove the transformation he can bring. The second time to judge the world. And we are living in the delay between Jesus coming once, which you can read about here, and Jesus coming on a day that he will judge every one of us and decide our eternal future. And the reason that the world is not yet perfect is that the world has not yet been judged. And the reason the world hasn't yet been judged is God is giving an opportunity for people to turn to Jesus and receive his forgiveness before he destroys all the evil in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a long answer.
Thank you. No, and great to explore that further on the Christianity Explored over 3 weeks. There's a lot packed in there and well worth pursuing. We've got, I think, about 4 minutes left. So short, snappy answers, Andrew, from here on in. To what extent is faith in Jesus a placebo? Isn't Jesus just a comfort blanket? Isn't it just wishful thinking to get us through the hard times and make life easier?
Sure. That's the question simply. Is it true? If it's nice but not true, then I'd actually say it's worthless. And actually, Jesus' followers say it's worthless. So the Apostle Paul, one of Jesus' followers, says, if Christ hasn't been raised, our faith is futile and we're to be pitied more than all men. Now, if Christians have got it wrong, then you should deride us and pity us. So it does matter if it's true. But Mark is writing not because he's got some nice ideas about how to make life happy, because remember, the guy who wrote this was almost certainly, along with the other early Christians, persecuted and suffered for what he said. It didn't make life easier for him, but he's saying it because he's convinced that it happened. And that's what you need to check out for yourself.
Thank you. I want to club these questions on happiness together. Life is full of ups and downs. Often the downs make the ups better. If one's always happy, won't the positive ups in life be muted? What is true happiness? How does Jesus give us true happiness? Some people might say that there is no such thing as happiness. What would you say to somebody who believes this? And why are there so many miserable Christians around? Are they really Christian? So relative happiness, downs and ups, and then what is real happiness?
Jesus says that true life, the point of life, the essence of life, is to know God and to know Jesus Christ, who he sent. And that's how he defines what life is really for. Now, maybe that doesn't sound very exciting to you. What he's saying is at the heart of life is a relationship. And I guess for most of us, the best thing about being alive is certain relationships we have, people that we love, and people that we love being around. And Jesus says the essence of life is to love and be around the one who made us, who is the best person we could ever know. And Jesus says that a relationship with him that goes on forever is the essence of joy and life to the full. Now, is it, you ask? Well, what can I say? My testimony is yes. You can ask other Christians around here, they'll say yes. But I guess maybe you won't believe us unless you try. That sounds like a sales line, doesn't it? But is there true happiness in knowing your Creator? Is there true happiness in knowing that the things that otherwise will ruin happiness, sickness and death and suffering, are within his hands? Is there true happiness in having the certain hope that one day Jesus is coming the second time and all evil will be destroyed and the world will be perfect? I'm optimistic about that, yeah. And I think what you see, all we've got to go on really is what you see of what Jesus does in real people's lives. And you have the stories I read you from the Gospels, and you've got people on your tables. And check out, ask the question, does Jesus change people's lives for the better? Mm. And I've seen it again and again.
Thank you. I think that's a great thing. Well, a question here, what makes you happy now that you're a Christian? I think you've just answered that, but why not ask somebody who says they're a Christian on your table? That'd be a great question to turn to them with. Now, you say fear. We'll have one more after this. What do you mean by fear God? What do you mean to fear Jesus? How can you fear Jesus? And here, for our good, why is fear the right response?
Yeah, that's very helpful. And again and again in the Bible, when people encounter God, he says to them, don't be afraid. I think that's interesting because that he always has to say it. Because when people encounter God, they always are afraid. Because he's so infinitely bigger than us. I think that kind of captures it nicely. You're supposed to be a bit afraid, and then Jesus will say to you, don't be afraid. Because what it means is that you've realized that Jesus isn't just an irrelevance, and he's not just a mate, and he's not just there with something, with some lifestyle advice. He's someone much, much greater than us. And when we come face to face with him, our knees will knock. Because we are meeting the creator of the world. And so I think we should be a bit afraid, because that's a measure of having understood what a big deal he is. But then he'll say to us, don't be afraid, as he welcomes us in compassion into relationship with him.
Thank you. Andrew, I think we'll draw to a close there. Thank you very much indeed for helping us. Thanks for a great talk. Thanks for answering all those questions for us. Why don't you go and sit down? I've just got a couple of things to say. We'd love you to come back and see us some more. You can spend a lifetime learning to know and love the Lord Jesus Christ. And the Christianity Place Explored would be a great place if you've got questions you'd like just to drive a bit deeper on. And you've got the details there. Do think about it. At the back, as you go out, there's a table, and there's some people who are involved in the Christianity Explored course there on the table. And they would love to help you and tell you a bit about the course if you want any questions, which starts, as you can see, on the 12th of November or the 8th of November. Jot your details down there. We'll be in touch with you. If not, please do come and see us on a Sunday. We meet at 10:30, 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock here. Just come to one of those meetings, not all three, but we'd love you to come and join us here on a Sunday. As I say, drop in at the table. Please feel free to stay as long as you'd like and continue discussing things around the table. Thank you very much indeed for coming, and a big thank you to all those from the church family who've helped serve and cook as well. Thank you.